White Network presents. The International Jews Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Got messed up and Hadding is gone again. I had to hang up and Tan had to restart the whole system because it crashed, and I don't know what part Hadding played in that, and if he, I don't know. But anyway, I'm on a new call and I'm just going to continue reading until he shows up again. So I was I ended up saying that this David Franks had this special permission to have this he was given the job of beating all these British prisoners, and then he was allowed to have a British officer come once a month to check on them and spend a few hours with him, which was a dangerous practice, the writers say. And continuing on in the records of the Continental Congress is a request from Franks that he be permitted to go to New York, then the British headquarters. And such was the power of the man that his request was granted on condition that he pledged his word not to give any intelligence to the enemy and to return to Philadelphia. Wow, I mean, talk about gullible white people. This Jew is, you know, is going to pledge his word that he not give any intelligence as he was allowed to go into enemy territory, which was in New York, into the British headquarters, for some reason. In January 1778, 6 months before Benedict Arnold took command of Philadelphia, David Franks got himself into trouble. Now, you know, David Franks is the respectable citizen and businessman living in Philadelphia. And David Solesbury Franks is the young nephew who is now Benedict Arnold's aide-de-camp. So maybe I need to clear that up. A letter of, David Franks got into trouble. A letter of his was intercepted on its way to England. The letter was intended for Moses Franks of London and was concealed under cover of a letter to a captain in a regiment commanded by a British general who had married Franks' sister. It appears on the record of the American Congress that the contents of the letter manifests a disposition and intentions inimical to the safety and liberty of the United States. Whereupon it was, quote, resolved that Major General Arnold be directed to cause the said David Franks forthwith to be arrested and conveyed to the new Gaol, that prison, in this city, in Philadelphia, there to be confined until the further order of Congress. Okay, so I hope you understand that letter got him into trouble. And now he's under suspicion. Thus, Benedict Arnold comes into contact with another member of the Franks family whose name was to be closely associated with the great treason. They mean David Franks, who we've been talking about. And now begins a serpentine course of twistings and turnings which are so delightfully Jewish as to be worth restating, if only to show how true the race remains to its character through the centuries. That's interesting. And it is in October, about the 11th day of the month, Franks is imprisoned and remains a week in prison. Then, by strange reasoning, it is discovered that the United States has no jurisdiction over the charge of treason against the United States. They have an exclamation point after that in parentheses. I would call that some kind of Jewish legalese. And that the prisoner should be handed over to the Supreme Executive Council of the State of Pennsylvania. It follows that the State of Pennsylvania has nothing to do with the crime of treason, against the United States either. And in spite of the contents of the letter and the findings of the congressional committee thereon, David Franks smiles pleasantly and goes free. It was a time, of course, when much money was lent by Jews to public officials. The Jew Chaim Solomon was credited with having most of the, quote, fathers, unquote, on his books. I guess that means the public officials, the fathers of the country. But he did not charge them interest nor principal. He grew immensely wealthy, however, and was recipient, in lieu of interest and repayment, of many official favors. David Franks, likewise a wealthy man, charged with treason, has his case transferred and finally dismissed. It is a trick not unknown today. Well, I'd like to point out here that, you know, we could ask, who are the traitors then if they're not these public officials? And American public officials who want to get rich. The lesson here, too, is that Jews always have used money to get what they want. That's something that should be like lesson number one or something, you know, to always remember and keep in mind. It's always true. Jews use money to get what they want. They buy what they want and they buy people off. So this is just another example of it. The Jewish records give much credit to Mr. Franks for not being daunted by this experience. Whether he is entitled to particular credit for his courage when he was master of so much influence is a matter for the reader to decide, but that he was undaunted, his subsequent actions show. He is very soon on the records again with an appeal for permission for his secretary to go again to New York within the British lines. He appeals to the Council of Pennsylvania. The Council refers him to Congress. Congress says it has no objection if the Secretary will be governed by General George Washington's orders in the matter. Washington's aide-de-camp gives permission, and the Secretary gives sufficient bonds and sets out for New York. So, once again, the same thing is going on. Arrived in New York, the Secretary discovers that Mr. Frank's presence is necessary and has made all arrangements for his master to go to New York, having even secured British permission to pass the lines. It was made very easy for Congress. It had only to say yes. But this time Congress said no. The former escape of Frank's made people aware of an un-American influence at work. After his first arrest, he was regarded as dangerous to the American cause. He apparently succeeds in living well in Philadelphia in spite of his difficulties, living even gaily with the society of the city. Okay. Up to this time, David Franks had come into contact with the two principal figures in Arnold's treason. As purveyor to the captured troops, Franks had met and entertained, in 1776, the young and engaging Major Andre. Remember, we talked about him a little bit last week, but he was an unknown figure still. Major Andre, who in 1780 was to become the tragic victim of Arnold's perfidy. And in 1778, Franks had been the subject of an order of arrest given to General Benedict Arnold. Jacob Mordecai mentions that it was at Mr. Franks' house that he met Major Andre, then a paroled prisoner, who was passing his idle hours and exercising his talents in the most agreeable ways by taking a miniature likeness of the beautiful Miss Franks. And that is comes from the American Jewish Historical Society, Volume 6, page 41. Remember, at the beginning of last week, they said that they're going to be taking most of the historical information from Jewish sources. And they have been doing so, and this is another one. I think I can say that, we hung up this call and everything, I have a new call on the White Network here that if Hadding can call in again, and maybe he's afraid to do it, but I think it'd be okay if he calls in if he's got everything in order there, and could join in the program. But I don't want. I think that would be all right. Anyway, and we have Tan Staffel around too. So, but I will just continue because I don't really know what the problem is with Hadding. So in the meantime, Benedict Arnold was pursuing his career, a career strangely checkered with brilliant bravery and subtle knavery, a career sustained by the confidence of noble friends who believed in Arnold even against himself. Except for the strange power of holding friends in spite of what they knew about him, Arnold's career would have terminated before it did. The psychic gift of his and the desperate need of the Continental cause for military leaders held him on until his moral turpitude matured for the final collapse. As before stated, there is no intention to minimize Arnold's services to his country, but there is a determination to show what were his associations during the period of his moral decline and thus fill in the gaps of history and account for the distrust with which the American Congress regarded the young general. David Solsbury Franks, the Montreal Jew, who was an agent of the Franks Army Contractors Syndicate in Canada, came south to the American colonies with Arnold when the American Army retreated. In his own account of himself, written in 1789, 8 years after the treason, he makes so little of his association with Arnold that were it not for the reports of certain court-martial, it would be impossible to determine how close the two men had been. In this record of himself, as preserved in the 10th volume of the American Jewish Historical Society's publications, he admits leaving Canada with the Americans in 1776 and remaining attached to the American Army until the surrender of Burgoyne, which occurred late in 1777. He then lightly passes over an important period which saw the command of Philadelphia bestowed on General Arnold. He mentions simply that he was, quote, in Arnold's military family at West Point until his desertion, which was in 1780. Reference to the first court-martial of Arnold, in which Colonel David Solsbury Franks was Arnold's chief witness, will show, however, that Franks and Arnold were more closely associated than the former would care to admit after Arnold's name had become anathema. Indeed, as the Jewish Historical Society's note correctly observes, the account of this court-martial is of much interest, as it bears directly upon the relations of General Arnold and his aide, Major David S. Franks, before the traitor's final flight in September 1780. There were, in all, 8 charges preferred against Arnold, the second one being, in having shut up the shops and stores on his arrival in the city, Philadelphia, so as even to prevent officers of the army from purchasing, while he privately made considerable purchases for his own benefit, as is alleged and believed. Follows a supporting affidavit, printed in the style of the original, with emphatic italics added. I don't have the italics in my copy, but supposedly maybe we can kind of imagine where they would be. On the 7th day of May, A.D., 1779, I'm quoting now from this affidavit, before me, Plunkett Fleason, Esquire, one of the justices, etc., for the city of Philadelphia, comes, he's Plunkett Fleason, the guy who's writing this affidavit. Before him comes, before me, he says, comes Colonel John Fitzgerald, late aide-de-camp of His Excellency General Washington, and being duly sworn according to law, deposeth and saith that on the evening of the day on which the British forces left Philadelphia, he and Major David S. Franks, aide-de-camp to Major Arnold, went to the house of Miss Brackenberry and lodged there that night. And the next morning, Major Franks, having gone downstairs, the deponent going into the front room of the said house, that's this guy, to view Colonel Jackson's regiment then marching into the city, saw lying in the window two open papers, that on casting his eyes on one of them, he was surprised it contained instructions to the said Major Franks to purchase European and East Indian goods in the city of Philadelphia, to any amount, for the payment of which the writer would furnish Major Franks with the money. And the same paper contained also a strict charge to the said Franks not to make known to his most intimate acquaintance that the writer was concerned in the proposed purchase, that these instructions were not signed, but appeared to the deponent to be in the handwriting of Major General Arnold, whether or not there was a date to it, the deponent doth not recollect. That the other paper contained instructions signed by Major General Arnold, directing Major Franks to purchase for the said General Arnold some necessaries for the use of his table. That the deponent compared the writing of the two papers and verily believes that they were both written by Major General Arnold's own hand. And soon afterward, Major Franks came into the room and took the papers away, as the deponent supposes. And further, the deponent saith not. Now, he doesn't say anything further. And it's sworn, etc., John Fitzgerald. So, okay, now this deponent was the aide-de-camp of General Washington. And of course, David, Colonel Franks was the aide-de-camp of General Arnold. And these letters were from General Arnold to him, and he had left them out in front of this window, I guess, on a table or desk or something. And this aide-de-camp of General Washington happened to see them. Now it goes on, that such a charge involved as much the trial of Major Franks as General Arnold will at once appear. The statements in the charge argue close association between Arnold and Franks. Yet, in Franks' written record of himself in 1789, he passes over this Philadelphia period thus lightly. And quoting from there, this is the Franks' written record of himself. He writes, in 1778... After the evacuation of this is his defense. In 1778, after the evacuation of Philadelphia by the British Army, and on the arrival of Count d'Estaing, I procured letters of recommendation from the Board of War and joined him off Sandy Hook. I continued with that admiral until he arrived at Rhode Island, where on the failure of the expedition, I returned to Philadelphia, where my military duty called me. This is the trial of Major Franks, is it? I didn't even get to study this very well before tonight, and here I am reading it. It is the trial of Major Franks, and this is a statement in Frank's written record. Okay, this is regular. This is Major. I don't know. Is this David Franks? I'm a little confused about it. But they say no reference here nor anywhere in his record to a closeness of bond between the two, which his testimony now offered from the records amply proves to have existed. Another quote. The judge advocate produced, continuing from the same record, the judge advocate produced Major Franks, aide-de-camp to Major General Arnold. Now, this is David S. Franks, so it's Major Franks, okay. Before he was a colonel, now he's suddenly a major, and he was sworn. Major Franks was sworn. The question is, on General Arnold's arrival in Philadelphia, do you know whether himself or any person on his account made any considerable purchases of goods? And the answer by Major Franks is, I do not. Question, at or before General Arnold's arrival in Philadelphia, did you receive orders from General Arnold to purchase goods, or do you know of General Arnold's having given orders to any other person to make purchases of goods? And he answered, I did receive from General Arnold that paper which Colonel Fitzgerald has mentioned in his deposition. There are circumstances leading to it which I must explain. I had, by being in the army, injured my private affairs very considerably, and meant to leave it, meaning the army, if a proper opportunity to enter into business should happen. I had several conversations on the subject with General Arnold, who promised me all the assistance in his power. He was to participate in the profits of the business I was to enter into. At that time, previous to our going to Philadelphia, I had several particular conversations with him and thought that the period in which I might leave the army with honor and enter into business had come. I received at that time, or about that time, I think, several days before the enemy evacuated the city, the paper mentioned in Colonel Fitzgerald's deposition that was not signed, as well as the other. I still took those things that were read that Fitzgerald saw. Upon our coming into town, we had a variety of military business to do. I did not purchase any goods, neither did I leave the army. That paper was entirely neglected. Neither did I think anything concerning it until I heard of Colonel Fitzgerald's deposition. General Arnold has told me since, which is since I came from Carolina. Let me move this up so I can get all of this. These sentences get a little... These people spoke in a very much more complex manner than we do today. I swear, I do believe we have really dumbed down. He says that, no, well, where was I? General Arnold has told me since, which is since I came from Carolina sometime in August last, that the reason for his not supporting me in business was, supposing I had left the army, it was incompatible with His Excellency's instructions and the resolution of Congress, unquote. This testimony, our writers say, seemingly straightforward in form, is rather damning to the characters of both the men involved. Arnold, upon taking command of Philadelphia, ordered the stores and shops to be closed and no goods sold. He stopped business outright. It was a most unpopular order because it prevented the merchants profiting by the new order of things, the return of the Americans. The very next day, the closing law is in force. Arnold writes an order to Franks to make large purchases of European and East Indian goods to any amount, in quote, to any amount, unquote, and to keep the transaction secret from his most intimate acquaintance. That is, Benedict Arnold and the Jewish major on his staff have an understanding that under cover of the military closing, they will loot the city of its most profitable goods at the enforced low selling prices for the obvious purpose of selling at higher prices when the military order was rescinded. Well, if this is not the Jewish nature and the Jewish method, Jewish order of things to bring down prices, buy stuff, push up prices, sell stuff. You know, this is nothing has changed in how they do this for hundreds of years. And they still do it exactly the same today. These are undisputed facts. Colonel Fitzgerald saw the papers, that was the aide to Washington, saw the papers and knew the unsigned one to be in Arnold's handwriting, even as the signed one was. They were both addressed to the Jewish Major Franks. In his testimony, Major Franks admits the existence of the unsigned order, as Colonel Fitzgerald saw it, and admits also its character. Even Benedict Arnold admitted the order, but he endeavored to show that having exhibited General Washington's order to him, meaning to him Arnold, to Arnold, to command Philadelphia, that fact would be a sufficient countermand to the order given to Franks to load up on valuable goods. Now this is a quote. General Arnold to Major Franks. Did you not suppose my showing you the instructions from General Washington to me previous to your going into the city a sufficient countermand of the order I had given you to purchase goods? It's hard to say what this is, if this is supposed to be General Arnold questioning Major Franks in the, you know, in front of this whatever it is, commission or whatever. But then Major Franks, supposedly, it says Major Franks, period, I did not form any supposition on the subject, unquote. And then our writers go on. This admission that he wrote the order and the fact that no large purchases of goods could be shown constituted Arnold's defense. Okay, since it was never carried out, I guess. It requires no keen legal mind to show its weakness. If the order was countermanded several days before they entered the city, what was it doing in Miss Brackenberry's house in Philadelphia on the first morning of Arnold's command and the first morning of the operation of his order to close the stores? And why did Franks come in search of it? Discarded orders are not thus carried around and preserved. Mm-hmm. Probably no purchases were made. Probably the order was not carried out. When Colonel Fitzgerald walked into the room early in the morning and saw the papers, and when soon thereafter Major Franks walked into the room and saw both Colonel Fitzgerald and the papers, there was nothing else to do than to call the plan off. It had become known. Okay, so supposedly this seeing these papers was before the time when they were going to carry it out. So, now, continuing on, Colonel Fitzgerald waited in the room to see what became of the papers. He saw the Jew Franks come and get them. He saw him go out with them. He knew what those papers directed the Jew to do, and he knew that the directing hand was Benedict Arnold's. The way they talk here, calling him the Jew, they're implying very strongly that the Americans of the revolutionary time were aware of Jews, were not completely, didn't see Jews as being one of their themselves, and yet they Jews were, you know, were allowed. And well, for one thing, people in higher places. This is what we mentioned earlier. The political what was that? The political leaders. The authorities and so on, they called him at one point the father. So the members of Congress, when this was early on, well, this was even before the country was even formed. So these were the people, though, in the Continental Congress people who were benefiting, who were selling out, allowing Jews to carry on business because they prospered from it. They didn't get rich like the Jews got rich. They just got a little bit wealthier, that was enough for them. So that's how these Jews, but the other people knew a Jew, apparently, and we're not fully trusting of Jews, and they so that I think that's very interesting. I may not have expressed it too well, but so he says, doubtless, the writers say, doubtless with this clue, he kept his eye, that is Fitzgerald, kept his eyes open in Philadelphia during the operation of the closing order. And doubtless Franks lost no time in transmitting to General Arnold the fact that he found Colonel Fitzgerald in the room. Where the papers had been left, the inadvertent visit of Colonel Fitzgerald is the key fact in that phase of the matter. But the Jewish major becomes talkative, in his effort to explain the situation. So we're talking about Major Franks. Quote, there are circumstances which I must explain, he says. And then in words that were frequently in the mouth of Arnold, that he's repeating things Arnold said, he represents that his service in the army was injuring his private affairs very seriously, and that he was contemplating retiring from the army and going into business. It is worth noting at this point that numerous opportunities were given Franks to retire, both before and after the Arnold treason. But he developed into a persistent clamorer after official jobs. In spite of his testimony, he could not be shaken loose from public employment. And then Franks revealed the whole secret of his relations with Arnold. They were in close association in profiteering matters. Quote, Frank said, I had several conversations on the subject with General Arnold. He was to participate in the profits of the business I was to enter into. Arnold was to remain a general in the army. His aide was to get out of the army and work with him privately, sharing the profits. I don't know if I read that too. I'm going to repeat that. Frank said was, I had several conversations on the subject with General Arnold. He was to participate in the profits of the business I was to enter into. That's the end of the quote. Then the writers say Arnold was to remain a general in the army. His aide was to get out of the army and work with him privately, sharing the profits. But what had all this to do with the orders to close the stores at Philadelphia? What had this to do with the papers found by Colonel Fitzgerald? For after all, this was the circumstance which Major Franks had set out to explain. At last he reaches it. Quote, at that time, previous to our going to Philadelphia, I had several particular conversations with him. I received at that time, or about that time, the paper mentioned in Colonel Fitzgerald's deposition, which was not signed, as well as the other. Unquote. The writers say the paper authorized him to get the most merchantable goods out of the closed stores. It followed upon several particular conversations about the business of which Arnold was to participate in the profits. But apparently the deal did not go through. Colonel Fitzgerald's untimely appearance and the carelessness of someone in leaving the papers about were most unfavorable to the Arnold Franks project. Well, I think we covered that already, but they covered it again. Now, there can be no question of the intimacy of the relations between the Jew and Arnold, and the use that both made of their relationship. There can be no question either that these relationships must have been the result of continuous acquaintance and testing. Merely to show that a Jew once crossed the path of Benedict Arnold and was implicated with him in a discreditable scheme that probably did not fully mature means nothing. But that this Jew was involved in Arnold's fortunes from the time the two first met in Canada until the day that Arnold betrayed his country may mean something. And that is the case. That is the case. From the time of their first meeting, their lines run along together. Frank always being relied upon by Arnold as the credible witness who extricates him from his scrapes, and Frank's usually doing it with a sort of clumsy success, as in the instance just cited. The reader may refer now to the reference made above to Frank's record of himself, in which he mentions having joined Count D'Estaing, the French admiral, at Sandy Hook. This was just a month after Arnold took command at Philadelphia, just a month after the events on which the above charge was based. Evidently, Franks got out of town for a little while. He would notice the coolness of his fellow officers, among whom reports of Colonel Fitzgerald's discovery must have circulated. There would be no prejudice against him because he was a Jew. It would be solely due to the suspicions concerning him. Indeed, readers of the ordinary history will never learn that Arnold had Jews around him. There were David Franks, moneyed man and merchant in the city. That is, he was known only as a wealthy man and a merchant. And David Solisbury Franks on Arnold's staff, both outstanding figures, yet wholly passed over by the historians, with one or two exceptions, and even these have never caught the Jewish clue. In that day, there was no prejudice against Jews, even as there is none now. Well, they're say opposite what I was saying earlier from the way they were writing that, so I imagine there's that's not 100% true, but they want to make the point that this was not bad thing for this country. They want to make the point that there was a basis for these people as being seen as wrongdoers, not because they were Jews. Franks then easily gains letters. Franks the Jew. Easily gains letters which permit him to join the French fleet of D'Estaing within a month after the Philadelphia business. And strange to relate, at precisely the same time, Benedict Arnold conceived the notion that he too should go into the Navy. And a month after this appointment to Philadelphia, he writes to General Washington suggesting nothing less than that he be given command of the American Navy at precisely the time Major Franks takes to the water. Now, here's a quote. I don't know what it is, but must be the letter that Arnold wrote. Being obliged entirely to, being obliged entirely to neglect my private affairs since I have been in the service, Arnold writes to General Washington, has induced me to wish to retire from public business, unless an offer which my friends have mentioned should be made to me of the command of the Navy. Oh, so he's kind of threatening that he's going to retire unless he can be put in command of the Navy. I must beg leave to request your sentiments respecting a command in the Navy, unquote. So far as the historians have been able to discover, no one ever proposed such a thing as making Arnold the admiral of the American Navy. But then, the historians did not know David S. Franks. He, a landsman, had gone for a few weeks with the French ships. Perhaps he was the friend who mentioned the matter. At any rate, when Franks came off the ships again, it was to serve as witness once more for Benedict Arnold. The charges against Arnold were such as these: permitting an enemy ship to land and buying a share of her cargo, imposing menial service on soldiers, a charge brought about by the action of Major Franks. I guess Major Franks was imposing menial service on soldiers. Issuing passes unlawfully, the case in point being that of a Jewess named Levy. The use of army wagons for his private affairs, and so forth. Now, these were charges against Arnold. This is Major Frank's testimony concerning Arnold's permitting, quote, the charming Nancy to land at a United States port contrary to law. The question by the court. Do you know whether General Arnold purchased any part of the charming Nancy or her cargo? The charming Nancy is the name of a ship. Answer. I do not know of my own knowledge, but I have heard General Arnold say he did, and I've also heard Mr. Seagrove say he did. Question. Was it previous or subsequent to General Arnold's granting the pass? Answer. It was subsequent. That's that. The writers write, here is a complete admission of all the facts, but the defense consisted in laboriously showing, by means of quite leading questions addressed to Franks, that the owners of the Charming Nancy were indeed good Americans, though residing and doing business in enemy territory. Franks was rather useful in this part of the business, and the court overlooked the other elements. Simply found, they simply found that the permission which Arnold gave to the Charming Nancy was illegal. The fact that a major general of the United States Army speculated, I'm sorry, I've got to go down here. I hit that thing in the middle again. That makes it jump, really jumped. Oh, I really, really jumped up. Sorry about that. Oh, golly, Moses. Okay. I already did that. Wow, I'm almost done here. Didn't know I was down so far. The charming were indeed good Americans. Wow. Okay. The fact that a major general of the United States Army speculated in the cargo of the ship which had come into port in violation of the law and on his military permission was not considered at all. Neither was the fact stated in the charge that he gave permission while he was in camp with General Washington at Valley Forge, whom he did not consult in any way. But here again, the fact is established that Major Franks was privy to the whole matter and was the chief witness for Arnold's defense. If it had occurred but once, as in Montreal, that Arnold had been charged with irregularities involving profitable goods, or if it had occurred but once, as at Philadelphia, that Major Franks happened to be the chief available witness, no serious notice could be taken of it. But time and again, Arnold is caught in shady acts involving profitable goods, and time and again, the Jewish Major Franks is his accomplice and chief witness. And this partnership in shady transactions, extending from the time Arnold first met Franks, till the time Arnold betrayed his country, is significant, at least as a contribution to history, and possibly as a sidelight on the gradual degeneration of Benedict Arnold. Arnold could no longer wholly escape, but still the good fortune that seemed patiently to accompany him, as if waiting for his better nature to recover from some dark spell, remained with him. The court could not exonerate him entirely, but neither could they punish him as he deserved. And so it was given as a verdict that General Arnold should be reprimanded by General Washington, his best friend. Washington's reprimand is one of the finest utterances in human record, they say. It would have saved a man in whom a shred of moral determination remained. And this is what they quote here from Washington. Our profession, I should get the right voice for him, but I don't know what it is. Our profession is the chastest of all. Even the shadow of a fault tarnishes the luster of our finest achievements. The least inadvertence may rob us of the public favor, so hard to be acquired. I reprimand you for having forgotten that in proportion as you have rendered yourself formidable to our enemies, you should have been guarded and temperate in your deportment toward your fellow citizens. Exhibit anew those noble qualities which have placed you on the list of our most valued commanders. I will myself furnish you, as far as it may be in my power, with opportunities of regaining the esteem of your country. Unquote. Oops. It was a bad day for Benedict Arnold when he got into touch with the Jewish Syndicate of Army Contractors. There is hope for him even yet if he would cast off the evil spell. But time pressed. Events were culminating. The alien, having gripped him, was about to make the best of the baleful opportunity. The closing chapter was about to be written in glory or in shame. That, the end of the chapter, ladies and gentlemen, and it was in the October 15th, 1921 issue of the Dearborn Independent. And now I have 6 minutes or so to talk about this by myself, and probably it's just what I have to say. Now, if anybody wants to call in and make a comment, you're welcome to do so. You know our number is 830-443-4911. You can call. Anybody can call. Even Hattie can call. But here we have this this man who has weaknesses. He's brave and he's good in the military because he's got this bravery and boldness. But he doesn't have the the virtues that that would make him control those things when he is able to enrich himself. And it was said last week that he seemed to be someone who wanted wealth, but a lot of people want wealth. Look at all these fathers of the country who are allowing these Jews to get these jobs, even and they were allowing themselves to get to not be charged the interest and to deal with the Jews as money men and not be charged the interest and the fees and so on that other people were. And for that, they gave the favors to these wealthy Jews. This is terrible, you know. So when you see that going on, why should you be so, so strict with yourself about your honesty and your honorableness? But of course, we would hope people would be, but that's why, I think that is, look how bad that has become now in our country and in all over the world. I mean, it's called corruption and corrupt, you know, governments being corrupt. There's so much corruption. And anyway, he was corrupted and he associated himself with these Jews and they had no real loyalty to the United States, effort here, you know, the new little country that was trying to be formed and so on. They were just there to make money, and so they would deal on with both sides however they could to make their profits. And he became the same thing, I would say, Arnold. He became the same way. He was just out to make money, and he didn't care, you know, what's really that much for either side. And he did, as you probably all know, and we'll find out next week, but he did go over to the British side, and he didn't. He, by doing that, he saved himself from the punishments that he would have gotten from the Continental Army. He after the war, after the victory of the Continental Army, he went to Britain and lived and married and had a, maybe he was already married, but he lived out a fine life in a country estate or something like that. I mean, he didn't suffer for any of it. He came out ahead like the Jews always do. They never get prosecuted. I mean, they might get prosecuted, but they always get off, and they hardly any Jew ever gets punished for what they've done. So this is discouraging, and but it also shows us the kind of society that we have with Jews in power. If there's too many Jews, and Jews are in power, and they're really in power now. So this has to be overthrown. I mean, we can't function in a society such as this, when there's no morality, and it's only about what we always come back down to here at the White Network: what's good for the Jews. That's the only morality that they have, is what's good for the Jews, and that's why we think we need to have a morality of what's good for the whites. It's not immoral to do that, because what is immoral is for the whole world societies to go down into total corruption, with the Jews on top, doing things the way they want to do and being the only ones to benefit. Well, I did hear now my 60-second prompt, so I think I may have, I'm not sure when the sound went off. I was reading, and then I finally looked up and noticed it. But I may have, and when I started again, I started where I remembered stopping reading. So I may have left out some portion of this. But if so, well, I guess there's nothing to be done about it. Now I have no idea what it was. This has been an interesting program tonight with all our breaks and changes and so on, but anyway, I think we got this. It came across all right. And next week we will be having the last part three, you might say, of the Benedict Arnold story. And we're coming to the close of our International Jew, although there's still quite a few weeks left, so it's not going to be until after the new year. So, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening tonight, and tune in again next week.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.